For those of you who were here last week, I want to kind of pick up where we left off, but for those of you who weren't, we'll make this a freestanding message, of course, as well. But, the notion that we were talking about last week of this constant judging that we do, you know, judging things great, judging them small, judging them important, judging them insignificant, this constant thing that we do in our head is something that is so destructive when it comes to the spiritual matters. Now, obviously, we got to do some judging and discerning in regular everyday life, right? You got to do that. If everything were of equal value, you'd be a basket case, a puddle on the floor. And so we have to do that. But when it comes to the interior things, when it comes to the important things in our spiritual lives, remember we said last week that once something approaches infinity, once something is infinite, it can't be measured. And something that can't be measured has no degree. And something that has no degree always looks the same. Do you see how that works? And if you can't measure it, if it has no degree, then it always looks the same. And this perfectly describes God's love. It's infinite. It has no degree. It can't be measured. And it always looks the same. Every one of us, as we approach God's love, it will look the same. Every one of us at every time and moment in our lives, no matter how good you judge yourself to be, how bad you judge yourself to be, how great, how small, how important, how insignificant, as you approach God's love, it always looks the same because it can't be measured and it has no degree. We read the wonderful little piece by Chuang Tzu, Chinese philosopher in the 3rd century B.C., and I want to just reprise one little section of it, and it's in your notes if you want to take a look. And those of you who know me know this is one of my favorite quotations. I use it so often, I probably have used it up by now. But he writes, "You cannot speak of ocean to a well frog, the creature of a narrower sphere. You cannot speak of ice to a summer insect, the creature of a season. But now that you have emerged from your narrow sphere and have seen the great ocean, you know your own significance, and I can speak to you of great principles." In the autumn floods, the river, which has swelled because all the flooding that has poured into it, is feeling his oats. His ego is swelling, and he thinks that he's the greatest thing since sliced bread because he's so wide and so powerful, until he empties into the ocean and sees the limitless expanse there and feels small and insignificant. And he speaks out to the ocean, and the ocean replies with this: "Now that you have seen your own insignificance, I can speak to you of great principles." That is one of the most profound statements. And Jesus echoes it in various ways throughout his ministry. It's not until you're emptied out that you can be filled. It's not until you have surrendered everything that you think you are and everything that you think you know, that you can take in something that you didn't have before. You know, there's this radical truth that we're all trying to understand. You know where the word radical comes from? We've so overused that word now, everything's radical. We don't even know what it means anymore. It sort of just means awesome, which is another word that doesn't mean anything anymore. You know, it's awesome, it's radical, it's this, it's that. Radical, the word radical, comes from the Latin word radix, R-A-D-I-X. You know what radix means? It means root. It's the same word we get radish from. Something that is radical is deep. It's profound. It's in our roots. It is not something that's superficial or superfluous. It's something that goes all the way to the bone. Something that goes all the way deep into the ground. A radical truth is a truth that has roots. A truth that digs deep into the truth of our lives and changes things profoundly from the inside out and from the bottom up. So, the more radical something is, let's think about this for a second, the harder it is for us to accept. The harder it is for us to surrender to. Why? Because, know it or not, each one of us has a radical truth that we live by. The experiences of our lives, starting with childhood, have taught us things that have gone deep into our radix, deep into our roots. The lessons of society, the lessons of the church, the lessons that we learned in school and all through our lives, the experiences of our lives, the hurts and the misfortunes and the joys and the successes, have all informed something that goes deep into our roots. That radical truth that we live by, we don't even necessarily understand that it is a point of view, an attitude toward life, because it's so deep. We just see it as reality. And so if Jesus is coming along and trying to bring us a radically different radical truth, unless we pull up all those roots first, what's going to happen? You all know that if you're pulling weeds in the yard and you just chop off at ground level, what happens? The same darn plant grows back, right? And this is what's going to happen with us. You know, we hear these radical truths in our churches and in our conversations, and we think we understand what is being communicated, and our head goes up and down, you know, and we agree and we mentally assent to that. And then before you know it, the same old plant's growing back up again. Because getting down to the roots takes time. Getting down to the roots takes effort. But if you don't pull them out by the roots, empty yourself out completely. See your own significance. Empty into the ocean of your insignificance. There is no way for something new to take root in your life. Gosh, I know this so keenly from my own experience. There are so many things that I thought I understood, theologically, spiritually, even emotionally, only to have old patterns continue to come back in my life and come back in my life, because I'd never gone through the process of pulling up those radical roots of the old belief system. You can only have one set of roots in your life. And so which one is it going to be? Which one is we going to do here? And there's nothing more radical than God's nature. Nothing more radical than who He is. We define that as love. We say God is love. Everything that we know about love or think we know about love is defined in God's nature. That's who He is. And we say we understand that. We understand that we're saved by grace. We understand all these theological niceties, and our heads go up and down. And then we run around. And the truth of our lives is not consistent with what we say we believe. If we say we believe in God's love, and yet our life is still based in fear, well, I'm not afraid. Well, then how stressed are you? How anxious are you? How close to the surface is your anger? You know, is this least thing likely to trigger you and set it off? How about fear? How about envy? How about frustration? How about depression? What does 1 John say? Take a look, 4:18 and 19. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves punishment, and the one who fears is not perfected in love. We love because He first loved us. The one who fears is not perfected in love. You want to know how much you believe in God's love? Do you want to know how much you believe in the radical nature of God? Take a look at the fear factor in your life. Measure your stress level, your anxiety level, your worry level. Jesus told us not to worry. It's not like you can grunt out non-worry, right? But when the love starts to take over, when we really start to grow those roots deep, there will be an effect. And the effect will be a dissipation of the fear. That's how we know that we really don't get it. Even though we say we do, even though intellectually we understand. How can we prepare ourselves for these great and radical principles that Jesus is trying to bring us? How can we know our own insignificance? How can we empty out the way that it seems to be that we're being led to do? The river empties into the ocean. That was easy for the river. How do we empty into our ocean? I want to read you a little bit from the 12 and 12 of all things. We are a recovery ministry after all. And I don't think it can be said any better than is said right here. Step one. Anyone want to just shout it out? No? We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol and our lives were unmanageable. For all you normies out there, I want to generalize this. The first thing that I started to understand when I started working in recovery, being a normie myself, was that this had less to do with alcohol and substance abuse per se, and more to do with a pattern of life, with dysfunctional and destructive behavior and compulsive behavior that we use to mask over these deeply set roots that are untrue, that we have come to believe. And so if you want to generalize this step, we admitted we were powerless over whatever compulsive behavior we find ourselves using to mask the fact that we're afraid every day. And our lives have become unmanageable. The 12 and 12 says about this step, who cares to admit complete defeat? Practically no one, of course. Every natural instinct cries out against the idea of personal powerlessness. Every instinct cries out against the idea of personal powerlessness. It is truly awful to admit that, glass in hand, we have warped our minds into such an obsession for destructive drinking that only an act of providence can remove it from us. We have warped our minds into such an obsession for whatever destructive behavior we are engaged in that only an act of God can remove it from us. No other kind of bankruptcy is like this one. Alcohol, now become the rapacious creditor, bleeds us of all self-sufficiency and all will to resist its demands. Once this stark fact is accepted, our bankruptcy as going human, as regards human concerns, is complete. But upon entering AA, we soon take quite another view of this absolute humiliation. We perceive that only through utter defeat are we able to take our first steps toward liberation and strength. Our admissions of personal powerlessness finally turn out to be firm bedrock upon which happy and purposeful lives may be built. We know that little good can come from any alcoholic who joins AA unless he has first accepted his devastating weakness and all its consequences. Until he so humbles himself, his sobriety, if any, will be precarious. Of real happiness, he will find none at all. Proved beyond doubt by an immense experience, this is one of the facts of AA life. The principle that we shall find no enduring strength until we first admit complete defeat is the main taproot from which our whole society has sprung and flowered. I want you to put that one on your refrigerator. We shall find no enduring strength until we admit complete defeat. Does that seem right to you? Are you still resisting that even mentally? Admitting powerlessness is an essential first step. Absolutely essential. I wrote a book called The Fifth Way, and the premise of The Fifth Way is that there are four ways that we typically get from point A to point B in our lives. And it comes from the four philosophies of Israel that were alive and in operation when Jesus was walking in the earth and performing his ministry. Each of those four main sects of the Hebrews, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Essenes, and the Zealots, each had their own way of dealing with the problems and the obstacles that they faced in their life. The Sadducees were the consummate insiders, you know. They were the yes men. They were the ones who just cozied up to anyone who came into power. If it was the Greeks, if it was the Romans, if it were the Idumeans, whoever. They were the ones who yielded to the powers that stood in their way. The Pharisees were the ones who were the manipulators, the influencers, who came inside the structure but tried to change it into their own image. The Essenes were the ones who set a pox on all your houses, and they hid out to the desert, and they exited the system. And the Zealots were the terrorists of their day, the ones who were trying to destroy whatever stood in their way. So to yield, to manipulate or influence, to destroy and to exit are the four ways. And think about this. In everything that we do, whether it's our marriages, whether it's our work, our school, our churches, whether it's our societies, our nations, our armies, these are the four choices that we have, isn't it? We can choose to yield, we can choose to influence, we can choose to exit or destroy. And each one of those is a way for us to express control over our environment, power and control over others, to try to have some sort of sense that we can do what we need to do and get what we need to get. But Jesus was bringing us a fifth way, a way that had nothing in common with any of the other four. In fact, it took the first four and turned them completely upside down and inside out and back to front. It was a way that was based in vulnerability and humility and powerlessness, not power of fullness. And it is so much a paradox in our thinking. It is so inconsistent with the way that we live our lives and the way things need to move in this world that it is difficult for us to grasp that radical truth that Jesus was bringing us. But the first step is to admit that we don't have any power. And who gives up power voluntarily? Really, think about it. In this life, who gives up power? There's one person I can think of, and it was George Washington, believe it or not. You know, when the Continental Army finally won the Revolutionary War, and George Washington was commissioned as the overall field commander, first thing he did was resign his commission and go back to Mount Vernon. Couldn't wait to get back and be a farmer again. And then when the new country developed the Articles of Federation and Confederation, and they didn't work, and it was falling apart, and they realized that a new and stronger union had to be created, and the Continental Congress was called, they realized they needed someone, a person, a figure who could occupy that office of president, who had the stature, the strength, and the universal respect to be able to hold this country together long enough for it to take. And there was only one person who could fit that bill. And they pleaded with Washington for weeks, even a couple of months, before he finally agreed to be president. And he did two terms, and he stepped down voluntarily, because there's no term limits back then, and gave his seat to someone else. But who does that? Who else does that? And even scholars disagree about Washington's motives. They don't paint him as such a wonderful guy. They said he had other motives. But regardless of the motives that he had, you know, here he was, giving up power. But what I want to even stress to you further is that giving up is not enough. Sometimes we think that giving up and surrender is the same thing. I'm here to tell you that it's not. Giving up is the end of resistance. Surrender is the beginning of submission. Let that sink in for a second. Giving up is the end of resistance, but surrender is the beginning of submission. And the two things are very different. Giving up can be a tactical retreat, just like chapter 11 bankruptcy. You know, you just stop this particular battle so you can live to fight another day. Surrender is the complete acceptance of your situation, seeing what is real, seeing who you really are, seeing your situation as it actually is. Giving up can admit none of that if it's just tactical. Surrender is the acceptance of the truth, the radical truth. What truth? There's a great scene in the Matrix, and those of you who have seen the Matrix, I hope most of you. The hero goes to the Oracle to get a word from the Oracle, and in her kind of waiting room, there's a bunch of children there doing all sorts of paranormal things, you know, levitating balls and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. And one little boy is bending spoons with his mind, and the hero comes up to him and watches him do it. And the little boy offers a spoon to him, and he says, "Don't try to bend the spoon. That's impossible. Only try to see the truth." And the hero asks, "What truth?" He says, "There is no spoon." Don't try to give up power. That's impossible. Our psyches won't let us do it. Our emotions won't let us do it. It's too difficult to give up the power you think you have, to try to get through another day, to mask your fears. Who gives that up? Don't try to give up your power. Only try to see the truth. What truth? You have no power. There is no power. We can give up an illusion, but we can't give up the real thing if we think it's real. It's too difficult for us to do. But to start to see the truth, to start to understand, is to realize that there is no enduring strength until we admit complete defeat. That's where we have to go. Jesus talks about this. Take a look at Matthew 5:3. The beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, the first shot across the bow, the first line, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Now we need to know what poor in spirit means. And to confuse things further, Luke just says, "Blessed are the poor." So we're thinking that Jesus has some, you know, particular affection for people who don't have physical wealth. This is not what it means. Poor in spirit, meskinan baruch in Aramaic, is an idiom. That means it's an expression that has a particular meaning that was agreed upon. And meskinan baruch means Someone who is humble. Someone who is dependent. Someone who is vulnerable. Someone who has an attitude of poverty, even if rich. That's the attitude of someone who is living in kingdom. They have an attitude of poverty, even if rich. In other words, they accept their powerlessness. Isn't it interesting that Jesus' first step at the Sermon on the Mount is the same as the first step of AA? It's the same principle. It's what he tries to get across. The poor in spirit are those who have finally seen and have accepted and are surrendering to the basic truth of their lives. What power do we have? Jesus said, can you turn by worrying one hair on your head from black to white? Can you add one inch to your stature, one hour to your life? If we can't do these most basic things, what power do we have over the basic things of life that are so essential to us? At Matthew 18:3, Jesus says, unless you are converted, and that word in the Aramaic really means to be changed inwardly, unless you are changed inwardly and become like young children, the word there, talia, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Unless you are changed inwardly and become like talia. Talia means two things. It means a child and it means a bondservant, a house or domestic slave. At the same time, the same word was used. And so Jesus is saying, unless you start to have the characteristics and the attitudes of the child, which is the complete dependence, you know, the sense of wonder, the sense of accepting everything at face value as it comes to you, not bringing preconceived notions to the table of your lives and your moments, but also of the servant, because a child can't help what the child is. The child is beneath the age of reason by definition. Has no choice in the matter, they just are. But the servant, the slave, has a choice. It may be only to choose or die, but it's still a choice. And that choice, that submission, that surrender to the circumstances of their lives makes all the difference when you mix the two together. To voluntarily submit, to surrender, to have the dependence, the vulnerability, and yet still the sense of wonder and gratitude, that's talia. That's kingdom. That's what Jesus is trying to get across. It's the same thing over and over again that we see in all of these. Meskina ruch. I love that word. What in your life do you think has prepared you to see your own powerlessness? Is there an incident? Is there a time in your life when you were faced with your own limitations? Love that line from Clint Eastwood. Man's got to know his limitations. I can almost sound like him with this voice. Have you been faced with your limitations? Have you been faced with your powerlessness? Was there a time in your life when you seemed to just empty out into the ocean and nothing was left? Was there ever a time when you were faced with that? I'll tell you, it came for me at the ending of my first marriage, about 20-some years ago now. I grew up Catholic, and pounded deep into my roots, into my radix, was the idea that once you're married, you're always married, and divorce is not acceptable. And when I got married, I thought it was for life. I believed that it would be for life. And when it started going bad, I just doubled down with my spirit, and I just tried to grin and bear it and make it work, because divorce was not acceptable. And if you did get divorced, you couldn't remarry unless you could get the annulment and all this kind of crazy stuff. But I just never expected to be a divorced man. And I certainly never expected to be a divorced man with a 3-year-old daughter who is now going through the hell of having to back and forth between homes and all of the interpersonal garbage that went along with that. And everything to that point just fell through the floorboards for me. I suddenly realized that I was capable of all the utmost folly that I thought that I could avoid, that I thought I was strong enough to get past or get around or get through. And I had to face myself as a failure. I had to see everything that I thought I was empty out into the ocean. But it was that emptiness, it was that sense of despair, it was that suicidal time in my life where I realized that I needed desperately, as quickly as possible, a new radical truth that could allow me to get through another 24 hours because everything had been stripped from me. I would never want to go through a divorce or wish any of you to go through a divorce. But I certainly hope you all get to that point where you realize that whatever roots you have are not deep enough to get you through what you need to get through. And you need desperately a new radical truth to finally come up to the shores of your own insignificance and be prepared to hear the great principles beyond, the radical truth that God has for us. I don't know if you have a moment like that. I see some heads going up and down. But the Bible gives us a vivid picture of just such a moment. You know that? How many of you ever really read Ecclesiastes? There you go. Someone back there who loves the melancholy, I guess, huh? It's one of those weird books. It seems so depressing. It seems so dark. It seems so antithetical to everything that we hear, at least in the New Testament, about hope and love and butterflies and puppies and all that. And here's this dark book tucked back there. But this book, written by Solomon, or someone in the name of Solomon, at the end of their life, at the point that their life has emptied out into the ocean, is seeing the bare truth, admitting, surrendering, accepting this truth, this leveling process that happens when we start to approach our own death, approach the end of everything that we have worked so hard to try to understand. At Ecclesiastes 1, second verse, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And that word there, vain, we think of it as being ego-centered, staring in the mirror. That's not what it's talking about here. Vanity is to make worthless in this context. That's what it means. It means it's worthless. It means it's as nothing. Vanity of vanities, all is nothing. All is dust. What advantage does a man have in all his work which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also, the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again, blowing toward the south, then turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along, and on its circular courses the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. All things are wearisome. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. There is no remembrance of earlier things, and also of the later things that will occur, there will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still. I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. Solomon, at the end of his life, has reached the ocean. He's been emptied into that sea. He is reportedly one of the richest and wealthiest kings of the ancient world, accumulated such wealth has never been gathered into one place before. Spent the last decades of his life searching after wisdom and became the wisest of the kings of the ancient world. And yet at the end, what happens? At the end, what is there? He writes further in the second chapter. I built for myself houses. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself, and I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and I had homeborn slaves. Also, I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after the wind, and there was no profit under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom, madness, and folly, and I saw that wisdom excels folly as light exceeds darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I know that one fate befalls them both. Then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity, for there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool. Inasmuch as in the coming days, all will be forgotten. And how the wise man and the fool alike die. The moment of our greatest personal fullness is also the moment of our greatest self-deception. Do you hear that? At the time that we think we've got it all is a time that we don't realize how deceived that we really are. But when that fullness empties out into ocean and we can see clearly for that moment who we really are, how dependent and vulnerable we are, that's when God can speak to us of great principles. Now that you have emerged from your narrow sphere and have seen the great ocean, you know your own significance. And I can speak to you of great principles. Until we know the truth of God's love, we're afraid of our vulnerability. And we cover that fear with the illusion of power, the illusion of control. And it brings a temporary relief, doesn't it? But the relief is only temporary, and it masks the growing problem underneath. And it will never take us where we really want to go. We will never get the great principles that God is trying to give us. Just a short passage from the Fifth Way. Our natural response to a broken heart is to try to cover our vulnerability with power. Assumed control over the people and circumstances of our lives gives us temporary relief from the pain, but the tools of control are the tools of the four ways. They'll only take us so far, and they'll never mend our broken hearts. There is only one way out or through, and it involves the death of our illusions and rebirth into truth. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Yeshua, Jesus, tells Nicodemus in John 3. Yeshua is the way, the truth, and the life, as he demonstrates the only way to the Father through the process of his life, death, and resurrection. The first step is to recognize our utter powerlessness, to let go, to be willing to start over again in complete dependence and insignificance, but in a new place, full of new sights and sounds and adventure that for all our newfound smallness is still greater than we were before. Remember, Jesus said, John the Baptist may have been the greatest of the prophets born of woman, but the least in the kingdom is still greater than he. Strange saying until you put it in this context and understand where Jesus is driving us. Getting to be a long time ago, about 5 years ago, Brennan was only two, and we all set off on a walk through the nature trail that's near our house. And I was in the lead, and I was pushing Brennan, two-year-old Brennan, little guy, in one of those sling kind of strollers, you know. So he's way down there, and I'm pushing, and we're going through this path. And as we got up into the hills, the path starts to narrow. And it was in the springtime, after lots of rains. And so, you know, the mustard grass that grows on these hills out here, that tall green grass will get up to chest, neck, sometimes head high. It's just all those beautiful yellow flowers on the top of it. That grass was that high. It was about neck and head high as we were walking through it. And as the path started to narrow, the grass was right at the edge. And so you're walking and kind of brushing through with your shoulders. And some of the fronds from the stalks were brushing against Brennan's head as going through. And, you know, all I could see was just the top of his head and the wind kind of ruffling through his fine little feather hair that he had at the time. But as we were going through, we were barely going through this tiny little passageway, and I noticed that Brennan had gone completely silent and completely still. And I looked down at him, and I was trying to see what was going on, but he was just riveted, looking straight forward. And I looked down the path to see what it was that he could have been looking at. And all of a sudden, a thought struck me. And I leaned way down, almost doubled over, so that I had my head right at his level. And suddenly, everything transformed. Because as I was walking along at my height, I could see over the top of the grass, and I could see the parking lot, and I could see the road beyond with the cars, and I could see the housing tract beyond that, and the mountains beyond that, all the familiar things that were part of my life, all the things that connected me to that life, made me feel secure, made me feel powerful. But when I dropped my head down to Brennan's level, suddenly everything changed, because those mustard bushes suddenly became trees in a forest that were high overhead. And this path could have been hundreds of miles away from the nearest anything that spoke of civilization. And it looked like it was just moving into infinity and curving around. And I could almost imagine that we were in Middle Earth and it was a hobbit trail. And around this corner would come horses galloping, you know, kicking up clods of dirt with whatever creatures were riding these horses and the glint of hardened metal on their swords. And it just, everything changed. Everything transformed. Just by lowering my head to a different perspective, suddenly everything became new and different. And I don't know what was going through Brennan's head, of course. But I got a glimpse of the experience that he must have been having. Being reborn tears us from everything we know and think we understand. It takes us from all the comforting and familiar things we have piled up around ourselves in the effort to feel bounded and held and in control. It seems to require so much of us, so much loss, that we resist as long as we can. But rebirth doesn't take us from anything we actually possess. Let me say that again. Rebirth doesn't take us from anything we actually possess, but it offers everything that we do not. If we can find our way not to simply give up and stop resisting, but to truly surrender and take that first step, our rebirth will open the rest of the way to immense new experience, full of the adventure and exhilaration of possibilities we didn't even know existed. From the other side of his rebirth, Yeshua looks up at us from the standing height of a child, from the kneeling height of a servant at our feet. Did Yeshua have a rebirth? Did he need a rebirth? You bet he did. The Bible chronicles it. The gospel tells us he went into the desert for 40 days and had to purge all of his own compulsions through the temptations that he successfully negotiated during that time of his life. Jesus was reborn, and then he was raised again. But from the other side of that rebirth, Yeshua looks up at us from the standing height of a child, from the kneeling height of a servant at our feet, saying that what he has done, we can do, and greater things than these. There he is, way down there, with the wind combing through his hair, beckoning with his broad, blinding smile, and speaking with the unmistakable ring of the truth that makes us free. Because in all our powerlessness, there is one power we do possess, the power to choose his way. This is a radical truth, and I guarantee it's one we're not prepared for. But what does Paul tell us at Philippians 2:5? Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, being made in the likeness of men, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. He emptied himself. The word there, kenoo in Greek, the word kenosis is the emptying of Jesus. He emptied himself. He became a child. He became servant. He became talia. And here's the kicker for us and the part that's so hard for us to understand. If we want to look up to Jesus, We have to look down to the standing height of a child, to the kneeling height of the servant. This is who Jesus is. He is servant. He washes our feet. He allows his head to be lower than ours. Do you remember the king and I? Anna and the king? Remember that play? The king's head always had to be higher than Anna's. He said, your head will not be higher than mine. When I sit, you sit. When I kneel, you kneel. And there's that wonderful scene where he's walking and standing and sitting and reclining, and she's trying to keep her head lower than him the whole time. It's hilarious. Jesus is saying, it's okay if my head is lower than yours. I will kneel before you and wash your feet. I can be humble. I can be vulnerable. I am that kind of God. And I and the Father are one. This is a radical truth. Our God consents to have his head lower than ours. Our God consents to serve us. Our God loves us with that kind of love because that's who he is, not what he does. And if for a moment we could let those roots go deep and replace the roots that drive the fear in our lives, what would be changed? What kind of relationship would we have with God and with each other if we realize that our God is a servant God who allows himself to be vulnerable? How much easier would it be for us to do the same? And in that new relationship, to let go of the fear of our vulnerability and to revel in being dependent and interdependent creatures that can give and give and give and feel the joy in the connection that that creates, and not feel that there is any need to grasp, to hoard, to hang on. Everything changes in the definition of our relationship if we can allow this radical truth to begin to penetrate. But it can't until we empty out into the shores of our own powerlessness and allow the new truth to come in. Let's pray. Father, this is a difficult thing. Not going to pretend that it's not. It takes years of weed pulling, of eradicating roots sometimes, to be able to allow the next thing in. But help us to understand that this is the way of things. This is the way that you have created us and our universe. This is the way that you play out our relationship with each other and with you. Thank you for guiding us constantly. Thank you for never giving up on us and always drawing us. Thank you for being the kind of God who loves us with this unquenchable love and desire. We will begin to put our trust more and more in you day by day if we can just lean into you. Help us to do that much at least, to understand the kind of God that you are. And thank you, Father, for loving us. In Jesus' name, amen.